My name is Philip Nell. The name of my book is How to Draw the World: Harold and the Purple Crayon and the Making of a Children's Classic.
Philip Nell is the University Distinguished Professor of English at Kansas State University, and his new book is titled How to Draw the World: Harold and the Purple Crayon and the Making of a Children's Classic. I recently spoke with Dr. Nell about the structure of his book, which is made up of 30 short chapters that highlight what readers might miss from a preliminary reading of Harold and the Purple Crown, as well as some of the historical context surrounding the book's publication. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Philip Nell. So many of our listeners will be acquainted with Crockett Johnson's book, Harold and the Purple Crown. Your book, How to Draw the World, does a deep dive into this small picture book because it's part of the Children's Classics Critically series from Oxford University Press, which is for adults who enjoy revisiting classics from their youth and who are willing to complicate their relationship with those classics. What can readers expect from your book?
Well, in my particular book, I have 30 short chapters that looks closely at Harold and the Purple Crayon. It's kind of a case study in what you might miss if you don't look closely, if you underestimate the art and design of the picture book. For example, this seems to be an improvised story. Harold decides to take his crayon for a walk in the moonlight and draw a 64-page adventure. And yet, it is not. It is very, very carefully planned by Crockett Johnson. The whole book is one giant picture that is revealed one page or sometimes two pages at a time. So he must have mapped the whole thing out in advance and then decided which moments to reveal on each page. And that is one of the pleasures of looking at children's books closely, is that you see that these are art, you know, that children may have less height or vocabulary or power than grown-ups do, but children's books are not a lesser art form. They are art, and they require a particular kind of mind to create them.
I also made a note when I was reading this. You pointed out another curiosity that may have gone unnoticed, but that once you do, it's hard to ignore. You know, we're not ruining Harold for anybody, are we?
No, definitely not. I mean, in fact, you know, Crockett Johnson once said, never overlook the art of the seemingly simple. And he did feel a little overlooked because his work is much more complicated than people think it is. But I think the brilliance of it is that it encourages us to not see that. You know, it makes its artifice invisible, and that's why it works. So I don't think we're ruining it. And I also don't think he would mind if people noticed just how smart he was.
I want to get to how smart he was in a moment, but you mentioned that the book is made up of 30 small chapters, some barely more than a page in length. Why did you choose this format, and what are some of the subjects that these chapters dive into?
Well, I chose this format because I thought it would be fun. I wanted to write a book that was enjoyable to read and that was digestible, so I thought, let's deliver it in nice, tasty little bites. And each chapter is a kind of micro history into some facet of the book. You know, so for example, we look at the book's publication and the fact that his editor, Ursula Nordstrom at Harper, legendary editor at Harper, did not like it when she first thought and did not want to publish it at all. So that's an interesting little story about how this book that seemed like it wasn't going to be published at all became published. I also look at the fact that the book, with all its white space, inspired other artists, young artists, sometimes to draw in the book itself, which is interesting. And it's certainly not something that I can prove. This attracted more crayon vandalism than other books, but it did attract that. And it is also a book that inspired many artists. And so that's an interesting thing to think about. Why have so many creative people traced their own lineage or the genesis of their life as an artist back to this book? Prince, chose the color purple as his signature color because Harold and the Purple Crayon was his favorite book. To name but one example, humor, talk about humor, talk about the real Harold, who is Harold based on, lots of different subjects. And each chapter leads to the next chapter, too. I didn't, it's not a random collection of information. It's structured carefully, like Johnson's book, or I hope it is. And hopefully, it was so carefully structured that you didn't notice.
You know, this book struck me as an exegesis of sorts, where you look at the context surrounding the text. For example, when questioning Harold's race, you looked at a book that Johnson's wife, Ruth Krauss, and Maurice Sendak were working on at the same time, I Want to Paint My Bathroom Blue, which featured scenes of race integration. Or there's another chapter which explores the fact that Johnson wrote this while he was under investigation by the FBI, thinking he might be a concealed communist. Talk to me about the importance of this context.
Yeah, those are both great examples and probably examples that I should have used in answering your last question. So thank you for bringing them up. The context is important for a lot of reasons. Many readers of color and white readers have seen Harold as a black or brown character. So addressing the question of whether or not Harold is supposed to be seen that way is actually really important. If you think about the scarcity of books in 1955 that had a character who could be interpreted as black or brown or who was intentionally so, certainly mainstream books in the United States, very, very few. So that is why I pursued that as a question. And it's very much connected to the fact that Johnson was under investigation by the FBI, because if you were coming out in favor of civil rights in 1955, one of the charges leveled against you was that you were a communist. And Johnson actually did work for a communist newspaper in the 1930s. So the allegation has roots other than that in his case. I don't have any evidence that he actually was a capital C communist, member of the Communist Party. And he certainly wasn't in the 1950s, but he was watched. And I do have his FBI file. The FBI were keeping tabs on him. It's a 114-page file, relatively small as those files go, but also quite real. So, in terms of thinking about the book in that context, you have somebody who is under investigation, who is looking out the window and can see the FBI agents parked in a car from his window, and is creating the story in which a child with a crayon creates a new world, escapes, leaves, imagines a different world. And so you could read this as him escaping through fantasy via Harold and the Purple Crayon. You could also read it as why we need the imagination under times of duress, that we are capable of imagining a different world, imagining a better world, that even when things look bleak, even when things look dark, we have this resource, the imagination, which we can use to help us survive. And so you can also look at it that way too. So those are great examples, and thank you for returning my attention to them.
So this book is not your first dive into Crockett Johnson. You wrote a biography of Johnson and his wife, Ruth Krauss. You mention in the book that you don't remember the first time you picked up Harold and the Purple Crayon, but when you discovered it again as a teenager, it was definitely a memory. What brings you back to this book time and time again? And talk to me about the value of reading children's books as an adult.
Yeah. It was a favorite as a child, but I only know that because I remember remembering it as a favorite of a child. And one of the reasons that I mention that is that because we encounter children's books when we are so young, they have a potentially greater effect on the formation of ourselves than art we read later in life. And so that's one of the reasons I mention it. The other reason that I mention it is that children's books have much to give those of us who are no longer children. We often wrongly dismiss children's books as, well, they're just for children. But in addition to being art, they can also be art for us grown-ups too. So I returned to Harold and the Purple Crayon when I was a teenager at a new school, and I found great comfort in this book, in which this child is able to find his way in the world via his imagination, perhaps because I was then doing that myself. Or perhaps because the book returned me to the delights of early childhood when I discovered at the age of three that I could read. Those delights that I think we sometimes lose a little bit as we grow up, that sense of getting lost in a book, that for me is much rarer now than it was when I was young. And so I think children's books can also reactivate that sense of wonder that sometimes seems more distant, encumbered as we are by the cares and anxieties of living in this world. So yeah, there are many reasons to return to children's books as adults. And I mean, I guess I would just also say that in general, children's books form heuristics. They form rule of thumb strategies for thinking about the world. They tell us who matters. They tell us whose stories matter. They tell us what kinds of stories are possible. So I think looking at children's books closely is something that we should all do. They are books we should take really more seriously than we take any other book, certainly.
In your research of Crockett Johnson, did you discover anything that surprised you?
Oh, wow. Did I discover anything that surprised me? I mean, in some ways, all of it. I had never written a biography before. So part of what was surprising was discovering that the answers that you need are in the world somewhere, whether those answers are a specific fact that you uncover or not, or just the context that allows you to write what you need to write. I think that probably surprised me the most in writing the biography, a double biography of Johnson and Krauss. There's just so many things that were charming. I mean, he had a very slow and deliberate manner of speech. He had a sense of humor that was quite wry, and clever. And it was the sort of observation that would make people chuckle. He was an ex-football player, kind of a gentle giant. He was just shy of 6 feet tall and had an extraordinary curiosity about the world. He only had a high school education, but he was an autodidact and really quite brilliant. He has three phases to his career. The first is as a cartoonist, the second is as a children's book writer, and the third is as a mathematician. He spent his last 10 years painting geometric images that illustrated theorems, illustrated mathematical theorems. And in the process, he actually published two original theorems of his own, theorems that he worked out visually. He worked out via painting them until he came up with the solution via painting. And then he would consult mathematicians so he could express it algebraically as well. So that was kind of astonishing. And really, I think speaks to the genius behind the work. This was a guy who was very smart, very, very smart. In fact, one of his characters in his comic strip, Barnaby, which was a favorite of the Smart Set, and it's one of those classic comic strips like Crazy Cat or Peanuts, although doesn't never had the wide popularity of Peanuts, but it's one of those classic comic strips. But one of his characters in that actually speaks in equations, or uses equations as devices to jog his memory, and the equations are real. When you simplify them, they actually spell what the character is trying to say. So yeah, maybe that's the most surprising thing, is that he was a very smart guy who, I don't know if he'd maybe been able to go to college, might have become a mathematician rather than an artist. I don't know.
Yeah, I alluded earlier to the fact that I was going to come back around to you mentioned how smart he was, but you just answered the question I didn't ask, so I'm not going to ask that. But this may or may not surprise listeners, but Crockett Johnson's favorite color was
Brown.
not purple.
No, he dressed in brown. His closet was mostly full of brown clothes. And I think the connection to Harold and the Hopewell Crane is minimalism. Both Johnson and Harold have a very minimalist aesthetic, and his own style was that too. Brown goes with brown. It removes the necessity of making a decision about what you're wearing on any given day. So the cover of Harold the Purple Crayon is brown. Harold himself is tan-hued. The Garamond typeface in the book and the outline of Harold is brown. So there is brown in the book, even though what you remember is purple. But perhaps that also connects to why Johnson chose brown. There's a kind of invisibility to it. It's a sort of a background color. Not important. So yeah, brown is his favorite color.
You just mentioned the Garamond typeface, and you mentioned like Gaudi, and I always love learning about. I do look at the back of the book to see what the book is
Yeah.
set in, and I love that. But I really enjoyed seeing the letters to Crockett Johnson from his editor. They were typewritten, and they felt like such a bygone era. I mean, you had to wait on the post for feedback on your pitch. You know, but one thing that really surprised me was that when Johnson's editor wanted him to write another Harold book, he was uninspired. So he asked to have the managing editor write a blurb because in the past he had wished that he had had the blurb before he got tangled in the book. So she did, and then what was the result?
Yeah, this was actually for the final Harold book, for the seventh Harold book that he wrote, Harold's ABC. And Susan Hirschman is responsible for writing the blurb, who, like Ursula Nordstrom, Johnson's editor, and the Harper editor from the 40s through the 70s, who edited so many great people, Susan Hirschman is also a really important person in the world of children's books. She founded Green Willow Books. She is the reason Kevin Henkes has a career. You may know his many picture books. But yeah, Susan Hirschman wrote a blurb for what she called Harold's Republic. And then that was what got Johnson started on writing Harold's ABC, the seventh and final Harold book. So she plays a role in the Harold multiverse and offering the genesis for that. And Harold's ABC is actually, it's even harder than Harold the Purple Crayon because it's an ABC book, right? So you've got the constraints of going through the alphabet. It's a narrative where we get one letter leading to the next. So that's an additional constraint. And each letter forms the word that Johnson is using. So the J in the jet becomes the wing of the jet. And he also brings in as many letters or as many words that begin with whatever the letter is as he's writing about it. So, like Harold the Purple Crayon is very difficult. Harold's ABC is, I think he just needed to challenge himself because that's even harder as a narrative to write because you have so many additional constraints beyond the challenge of writing this apparently improvised book that is, in fact, very carefully planned. So.
Can you talk more about the Children's Classics Critically series?
Yeah.
What's next in that series?
Well, what is next in that? So, my friend and co-editor Melanie Darshan-Bold and I are editing this for Oxford University Press. The Harold book is the first. I think the next three books will be on Paddington, Pippi Longstocking, and Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. Those are all under contract. And our plan was to have those all come out next year. We will see if our plan is fulfilled in the way that we wish it to be, but that's what we hope are the next three books. There are others that either are or will soon be under contract. One of those will be on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So the goal, though, is to not just revere books by white people. We're making three of every 10 of these representing a minoritized group. So we're trying very hard not to make this a series in which we look at all the great books by white folks. So we've built that into the series and hopefully we can pull it off. But that's also something we're trying to do in the series is invite people to expand their sense of what classic means and hopefully introduce people to some new classics as well. We also have to try to make that possible, you know, to have three of every 10 represent an underrepresented group. One of those three we've decided can be from the past 10 years. because there's been much more representation, much more inclusive representation in more recent times than there has been in the past. So that's something else that we're trying to do with the series.
You probably just answered this question, but what do you hope readers will take away from this book?
What do I hope people will take away from this book? I mean, I just hope they will take away what we can learn when we look closely at anything. I'm focusing on picture books. The series focuses on picture books, but you should focus on whatever art animates you. And when you look closely, you learn deeply. You know, I think modern life and the social media multiverse rewards immediacy, whatever grabs your attention, and then you scroll on by. So I hope people also take from this an invitation to stop scrolling and really look closely. Put the phone down and immerse yourself in art. And, you know, picture books are a great place to do that because they are portable art galleries. And because, for the moment at least, libraries are more accessible than art galleries. You can go to a library, get a picture book, and sit with it. And sit with it and with the child or children in your life, or not. You can also just sit with it on your own. So I hope people also accept the invitation to look, to listen closely to whatever it is that animates their curiosity.
You are the University Distinguished Professor of English at Kansas State University. Some of our listeners might have had you in class. Is there anything your students have taught you?
Oh, yeah, man, boy. Well, hello, students, if you are listening to this, and don't be afraid to reach out. Yes, I mean, the reason that we have discussions in literature classes is because each of us brings to a book our own unique set of experiences and understandings of the world. So, in any discussion, students will bring up ideas that I didn't have when I was reading the book. So, yes, I'm trying to think of a specific example. I've been teaching for 30 years, so it's like, wow, what would be the best example of that? I mean, I am struck in conversations about Harold because I do teach Harold, and I loved Harold as a child, but I'm struck by students who I find it kind of a nightmarish book, which other people have too, and I talk about this in the book, but who find it a little unsettling that Harold never leaves the existential uncertainty of the blank page. His only world is the world that he draws. And I find that really a really interesting response to it. And it's not unique to my students, I should say, but those are the kind of things that stand out to me and that I'm really intrigued by because they were not my experience. So I guess the thing I learned from my students the most is I love the experiences that are not mine. I love the experiences that are different from mine. I find those the most fascinating and the most enriching and what I learn the most from. So I think that would be my general answer from what I learned from my students. I like that they are unique humans and have ideas that I hadn't thought of and experiences that I haven't had. So I think that's what I like the most about students. Yeah, definitely.
Well, is there anything that you want to talk about that I didn't ask?
To build a better world, you have to imagine it first. And so that's why creativity is useful. You need to step outside of the confines that you have been consigned to and think about the world you want to live in. And get your purple crayons, metaphorically, and draw that world. I think that's what we all need to do. And we need to dream big. I don't think we should be afraid. I don't think we should obey in advance, to borrow the language of Timothy Snyder. No, I think we should fight for the world that we want to live in, that we want the next generations to live in. And to do that, we will need to be creative. We will need to figure out how we can make those dreams a reality, but absolutely dream and hold on to them and write them down now. Write them down before January 20th. I think that's other advice that I would offer. So autocracy has a way of grinding people down and causing the dreams to fade. So I would say write them down now and keep dreaming. And yeah, and don't give up. Don't give up. And a way to not give up is to keep dreaming, keep believing, keep your mind and imagination active. So
The book is How to Draw the World, Harold and the Purple Crown, and the Making of a Children's Classic. Philip Nell, thank you so much for joining us today.
hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed the conversation.
That was Philip Nell, author of the book How to Draw the World, Harold and the Purple Crown, and the Making of a Children's Classic, which was published by Oxford University Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.